Welcome to the House Committee on Judiciary. The chair is in a meeting. We'll be back in about 40 minutes. I'll be conducting the meeting in his absence. The way we'll proceed this afternoon is we're going to start with
Molly Carson,
House Bill 882A, and then we will jump to the top of the agenda and work it all the way down. I have three folks signed up for Senate Bill 882A. If you folks like to come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, while Chief Justice Carson and the others are getting up to the dais, Senate Bill 882A, as amended, is a pilot program. The engrossed version that you have today is a pilot program that would allow the presiding judge of the judicial district that's in the Warm Springs Tribal Reservation area, would allow that judicial district presiding judge to enter in a memorandum of understanding which would allow the tribal courts to deal with adjudication of delinquency matters. I want to make it clear that these are not the ones that are on the tribe. The tribe would have jurisdiction over these. These would be the ones that would occur in the surrounding areas that would normally have the juvenile court would normally have jurisdiction over. This would allow for those delinquency acts that are committed by Indian youth would allow the tribal courts to take those as well. And, of course, this is all subject to this memorandum of understanding, which the parties would work out, and then the chief would okay that.
Thank you, counsel. Witnesses, good afternoon. I don't know how you wish to proceed, but I'll let you decide that.
But Mr. Chairman, if I may, we've agreed that I can start, and then I will take my leave. And with my apologies, I have another meeting to attend, but I wanted to be here and report to you and the other members of the committee that the Judicial Department and I support this legislation, and my understanding is there will be an amendment that will include the Umatilla County and Umatilla Tribe. The Jefferson County, the courts in Jefferson County have worked long and hard, and I think Judge Ahern may express his, may relate to that or refer to that in building a good working relationship with the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. And this is a good program, and I fully support it, as does the Judicial Department. And I'll respond to questions if there are any, but I just want to make it clear we're in favor of it.
The chief has to go. Does anyone want to put him on the spot? I mean, ask him questions?
You have plenty of opportunity.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jensen.
Tell me about the memorandum of understanding, what all is expected to be in there, and is that totally at the discretion of the presiding judge and yourself to work out those arrangements, or what about the juvenile authorities in the counties? Will they be a player in working out what is in that memorandum of understanding?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I will defer to both Judge Ahern and the juvenile court people that are here, Matthew, and my understanding is that it takes the presiding judge and me to sign off of it on it, and it will be a cooperative effort, as I think Judge Ahern will report. The work that has gone into this bill already is a result of a cooperation between the various members of the county and the juvenile departments and others within that county. And as far as the details are concerned, I have not yet seen the memorandum of understanding, so I would prefer to dodge the question, if I may, and get somebody that probably knows more about it than I do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other thing. I've been just glancing at this. I haven't studied Major 11 crimes. When a 17-year-old does an armed robbery, does that stay the same, or do they go back to the reservation?
Well,
I mean, they may anyway. I mean, I know there's some discretion.
I can answer the first part, the easy part, and it's an adult crime. And so it doesn't become a part of the juvenile. There's no choice in it. There's remand of that stuff. So it would be an adult crime.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions of Chief Justice Carson? Hearing none, Judge,
you're
excused.
Chairman,
thank
members you. Of the committee, and now you get some real answers.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll try.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Vice Chair, my name's Dan Ahern. I'm a circuit court judge for the 22nd Judicial District. This is Matthew Burney. He serves as our juvenile director. And this is Jennifer Kimball. She's a defense attorney that practices within the 22nd Judicial District. Just to briefly explain the issue, living in Jefferson County, if a youth from our county were to happen to go to Portland for the Rose Festival or something and engage in behavior that they shouldn't do, and commit a delinquent act, Multnomah County has a choice to make. They can adjudicate that case, or they can refer it back to the county where that youth lives. And in the vast majority of cases, they choose to refer it back to the county where the youth lives. They can choose to adjudicate it first, mean having the hearing and establish jurisdiction, and then transfer it, or they can do it before that. Same thing when young kids from Marion County and Multnomah County come to Jefferson County to the Cove State Park and engage in behavior that they shouldn't do. Our county has jurisdiction because the offense occurred there, but we have the ability to refer that case back to the youth's home county, and in the vast majority of cases, we do that. Our county, the Warm Springs Indian Reservation, is located within our county. The youth that live in the Warm Springs Reservation attend schools off the reservation in the Madras area, and that begins in fifth grade. So, I mean, you're talking about kids that are 10 and 11 years old. We've been working with the tribe for about 6 years talking about this category of youth that commit acts off the reservation that, as the law is written now, we have exclusive jurisdiction over on delinquency matters, and we have expressed a desire to work with them to have those cases handled on the reservation. And we have done it informally. Prior to becoming a circuit court judge, I was a county judge for 6 years and had juvenile court jurisdiction. We referred all the cases to Warm Springs. We weren't so worried about complying with the statutes. But now that I'm a circuit court judge, I felt the obligation to take care of this little quirk. If there were ever a problem were to arise, there is no statutory authority for it. And that's what we're asking for. Addressing the memorandum of understanding that I think it was Representative Barker or Jensen addressed, the issues that we'd be looking at and need to discuss with the tribe, which is an equal player in this memorandum, is whether or not the tribal parents would have to agree to the referral back to the reservations. Obviously, there are differences between the two court systems. We'll address that. We'll address the type of offenses that are appropriate for transfer. We'll discuss the reporting back from the tribal court on cases that are referred to them, because we still feel we have an obligation to make sure those cases are handled appropriately. We feel it's a extremely good bill. We want your support for it. One of the best things about it is we're not asking for money. We just think this will help increase our cooperation between a sovereign nation that we deal with on a regular basis. This will give us the means to do that more efficiently and more effectively. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, and our juvenile director would be able to give his perspective, and a defense attorney is here to give her perspective.
Well, in the interest of time, I think we'll hear testimony from all the proponents, and then we'll ask questions.
Okay.
Go in any order you wish.
My name is Jennifer Kimball. I'm a defense attorney in Jefferson County, and I provide indigent defense services for the 22nd Circuit. Mr. Chair and committee members, I support this bill. I deal with 20 to 30 of these youth each year, and although they certainly have respect for our circuit court, nothing gets their attention more than dealing with their tribal elders and dealing with other people within their tribal community. We allow children, as Judge Ahern was saying, to be transferred to their own community. Within the state, we should do the same for tribal members. They know what services they're able to provide to these children, and they're better able to supervise these children day to day. The kids that I see, when I tell them, well, we're going to circuit court, that's one thing to them. But when I say, do you also have a tribal court case, they become very concerned, and concerned that maybe the tribe is going to find out about their incident in the county. And I think that it just gets their attention a great deal more, and is more of a deterrent to them when they're having to answer to their own community. And so I think it's certainly in the children's best interest that we formalize this process. Thank you.
Thank you.
Matthew Burney, Jefferson County Juvenile Department Director. I do support the bill and the concept of a memorandum of understanding between the Circuit Court and the Warm Springs Reservation. This is something that in Jefferson County and Warm Springs has been worked on for quite some time. And while in some the details of the memorandum of understanding will determine whether or not this is a workable or a good thing, but this legislation just allows us to have the authority to negotiate that. I also am obligated to testify that our district attorney as well as the District Attorneys Association and the juvenile director in Umatilla County do not support the amendment, nor do I for similar reasons. No groundwork has been done with the county in Umatilla and the Umatilla tribes regarding this proposed memorandum. And there are certainly concerns that the District Attorneys Association have and the Juvenile Directors Association have. Everyone supports a one district, one tribe pilot project where any potential serious problems can be worked out, some sort of a experiential track record can be developed, and then other areas of the state, both the other tribes and circuits and counties, can either take what the experience in Jefferson County and Warm Springs as a starting point, or decide that that's not something that would be beneficial. There is issues of due process, victims' rights. There's a lot of things that state law gives victims access to that are not available under tribal law. So the details of the memorandum of understanding are going to be very important as to whether this is a workable and positive thing or not. As Judge Ahern said, we do refer, I personally refer cases to Warm Springs on a regular basis, and we also keep cases. I don't think any memorandum of understanding will get support, certainly from me or the district attorneys, that transfers all cases to Warm Springs. Some cases clearly are more appropriate for the tribal authorities, and some aren't. So, and in my conversations just this morning with the Umatilla County Juvenile Director, there really hasn't been any conversations in Umatilla County about embarking upon this process, and that message third hand was also from the district attorney there. So while there are many benefits to there being a pilot project, to giving us the ability to negotiate a memorandum of understanding, I would encourage that this legislation is limited as proposed originally to Jefferson County and the Warm Springs Tribe. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions by the committee to the panel?
A question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. In Jefferson County, can you help me a little bit with the number of cases, juvenile cases, that would be eligible for this type of action, realizing that the memorandum of understanding hasn't been developed, and realizing that the particular crimes maybe have not been clearly articulated at this point, but can you help me a little bit with the number of cases that might be available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, approximately 200 referrals per year come to the County Juvenile Department for offenses committed by tribal enrolled youth. They're committed off of the reservation. I believe the last year we referred at intake about 40 cases back to the tribal court, kept the remainder. Those cases don't all represent individual youth, so there's fewer youth involved than that number of cases would indicate. All first and many second time misdemeanor, nonviolent offenses that don't involve a victim are referred back to the tribal authorities. Repeat offenders or more serious offenders or any offense that creates a victim outside of the reservation is retained.
Follow up?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. An additional question, I guess. do you have in Jefferson County, one judge that handles all of the juvenile cases, or are they spread around amongst the circuit court judges that are there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, there's three judges in the 22nd Judicial District, and two of us live in Jefferson County. I handle a third of the juvenile load, and the other judge handles two-thirds, and I handle a third in Crook County, and the judge there handles two-thirds. So it's pretty even.
So this is a two-county...
Yeah, a two-county district, but this will only affect the one, and there's two of them who do the vast majority of the juvenile work.
What would be the caseload in Crook County?
In Crook? Very few Warm Springs youth commit offenses in Crook County. They just... don't go there as often because the school that they attend is in Jefferson.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Anderson.
Yes. Are there non-tribal children that live on tribal lands?
Yes.
And how are they adjudicated? They're brought to your court.
Okay. Further questions to the panel? Okay, hearing none, we thank you for your participation. And I'm going to see if there's anyone else that's... that hasn't signed up, there may be a witness. I did get a card from Mr. Mason. Did you intend to testify?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Roger Martin, but very briefly.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, may I address a question that was asked by Representative Jensen of the Chief Justice?
You may.
Regarding the parties to the MOU, the legislation only requires that it is between the tribal courts and the circuit courts. So that is part of the concern in Umatilla County. In Jefferson County, I have no concerns about that. I know that our judges will include us in developing that MOU, but that just the conversations and the groundwork for having that kind of understanding haven't been laid in Umatilla County. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Fine. Thank you. Gentlemen, you may proceed in any order you wish.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman. We're going to go beauty before age for this one. But on Senate Bill, he didn't even laugh. That was bad.
Okay. He was nodded.
Right, yeah. The Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs and do support this legislation very strongly, as they did on the Senate side, and very much appreciate the cooperative effort of the 22nd District and the juvenile department over there. Everyone has worked very closely on trying to place kids in make sure that the cases are in the proper forum, which generally speaking for the residents of the reservation is the Warm Springs Tribal Court. And I don't think there's any question, I know there's no question about in coming up with this MOA that everyone will be at the table that's concerned with it, and that's how it's been approached over the last several years. But I did want to focus more on the -2 amendments, which we do also support. Our sister tribes, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, having an opportunity to negotiate an MOA for their, with Umatilla County at any rate, to Umatilla County courts, I should say, to do a similar thing. No one can say whether their MOA negotiations would be successful or not, but they would have an opportunity to pursue a pilot project there as well. And I just want to emphasize again what's already been testified to, that we find that the tribal youth respond very well to the tribal elders, and for historic reasons don't respond as well to the non-Indian courts and authority figures. So it's been very successful, the cooperative effort that we've had with Jefferson County courts on this and Jefferson County agencies. So again, thank you for your consideration. Ready to urge your do pass recommendation, and we do support the dash twos.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Roger Martin, and I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. We have been talking about this since it was first introduced. Incidentally, the bill was first introduced covered all the tribes in Oregon. It was amended back to cover just the Warm Springs. These amendments would expand it to also cover the Umatillas. From the standpoint of the Umatilla tribe, we would support the amendments, but only if they do not endanger the passage of the bill, because it is the Warm Springs and the two counties in central Oregon that were originally meant by this. The representative from the juvenile office in Jefferson County said there had been no cooperation. That's not exactly right. There have been conversations between the tribal judicial department or judge on the reservation, the Umatilla reservation, and someone in Umatilla County. We are unable at this time to get anyone on the phone. I heard this morning that the district attorney in Umatilla County was somehow concerned about this. I went to Representative Jensen. He's had a phone call in all day, and they're gone for the day. So perhaps one of the solutions to this would be to delay action on it until we can really determine, is there a problem? If there is a problem, we're going to bail out. If there isn't a problem, we would like very much to go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, in the interest of your concerns, it's not the intent of the chair to run this out on a work session today. We'll have a public hearing. We'll close the public hearing and come back.
Thank you.
Any questions of the panel? Representative Prozonsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Michael or Roger, I'm not sure, since we have not heard all the discussions and debate that went on the Senate side, understanding that this started out as being very broad, what was the hesitation for it to move forward? Because I'm just envisioning that if this is going to work over for Warm Springs, the Grand Ronde and others are going to potentially want this opportunity. And so I probably should have asked the question before, but I'd like to just kind of get some insight as to why we're at this juncture.
Well, if I could start the answer to that question, Chair Ackerman, Representative Prozonsky. The fact is that most of the tribes in Oregon do not have courts that are developed enough to handle this sort of case as yet. Most of them handle Indian Child Welfare Act cases, which involve foster placements and that sort of thing, dealing with dependent children, but they don't have juvenile codes as such. So that was one issue. And the other was the length of time that cooperation has taken place already on the Warm Springs. I think a concern was raised. I know a concern was raised by juvenile programs and DAs about doing this broadly without having had the preliminary discussions. So that's why I was paired back to just Warm Springs, as I understand it. But I defer to Judge Ahern on this, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Prozonsky, that is true. I mean, we have been working with the tribe for about 6 years, and we meet probably at least quarterly. And those meetings, we typically do invite our DA and juvenile director to attend. It is a slow process of working with the tribe and building up the trust that's necessary to get to this step where they'll appear and support this agreement. But probably what's even more challenging, and I think this committee probably more than others will have the appreciation, any bill that is involved in this, somebody's got to have the authority to decide what the agreement's going to look like. And I think the 36 juvenile directors feel it should be a juvenile director's decision. The 36 DAs think it should be a DA's decision. Oregon Youth Authority thinks it should be their decision. And you're not going to find a judge that doesn't think everything should be our decision. And like I said, I just want to at least get our ability to do this. And I think if we're allowed to do that, when we come back at the next session, when this is set to sunset, a lot of those fears can be put aside, and hopefully it will become a statewide bill or legislation, because I do think it will work statewide. But to avoid those anxiety that the various TERFs have. As he said, we just want to at least get ours in there. If everybody else can come along, that's fine, but we don't want to jeopardize passage of the bill. And
fair enough.
That's where we're at.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think I neglected to state that Michael Mason, for the record, and that I'm a lobbyist for the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs and happen also to be an attorney. Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Since witnesses have testified in relationship to what has transpired as far as Umatilla County and the Umatilla County tribes, or Umatilla tribe, Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and I'll get my things all straightened out here in just a moment, Mr. Martin. I think I just heard testimony from that it takes a long time to get the tribes to want to really buy into some of these things. I think it would be important for us to note that the Umatilla tribes at this point are at a point of wanting to be a part of this process. And the district attorney's office, unfortunately, when stuff goes out on our internet, amendments that we're holding here in committee do not appear to them, and the district attorney's office did not have access to those amendments, and it probably was my error in not faxing over the amendments. So the assumption, at least as I read his notes that he, on the callback he made yesterday, the assumption was that the memorandum of understanding would be the one that was developed on the Warm Springs. And clearly that, as I read the bill with the amendment, that would not be the case. The Umatilla and the 6th District Court would be the ones who would do the memorandum of understanding there. I've talked to the judge the judges, the presiding judge, and to the judge who does all of the juvenile work in Umatilla County, or almost all of the juvenile work in Umatilla County. They both are in favor and think it's a good idea. I've talked to Bill Johnson, who is the judge on the reservation, and from what I understand, one of the most knowledgeable people in the state on Indian law. He is in agreement with it. And also, I think like is taking place in Jefferson County, they already do some of the things that that are taking place. I do appreciate that the issue of needing to get some additional information, and I appreciate the chair's decision to hold it over. I'll do everything I can, and I would offer the Warm Springs tribe my assurance that I will not try to move anything through that would jeopardize the program that is already underway.
No. All right. I feel like I've come in the middle of the series here, but
are there like us to start?
No. Is there further questions for this panel? Okay, so it sounds like we've got a little spade work to do before we're ready to move the bill. So we'll close. Well, let me ask, is there anyone else on Senate Bill 882? All right, then we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 882. All right, and we're going to move to the top of the agenda and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 68.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 68 comes to you, I believe it's from the Oregon Law Commission, and Wendy Johnson's here. And this is a housekeeping bill that would amend and repeal the statutes that refer to repealed statutes, would change those and get them in line with the way our statutes read now.
Hi, welcome, Wendy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. This is the simplest bill that you'll have before you from the Oregon Law Commission. It has references to four statutes that were repealed last session but are still in statute. It's replaced with 419B923 of the existing statute. That's all there is to it. No, it's a consensus bill. It comes to you from the Juvenile Code Work Group, chaired by Senator Kate Brown.
Are there questions for Wendy? Thank you, Wendy.
Mm-hmm.
Going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 68. Open a work session. Now, Representative Ackerman, you see how easy that was?
Yeah.
You just move right to
Mr. Chair.
I appreciate the advice, Mr. Chair, but I will note that in all my experience, Senate Bill 68 is the only one that only has numerical changes, no changes in language or words. Now, that may make it eligible for the consent calendar.
Representative Ackerman, I'm going to take that as a motion. Representative Ackerman moves Senate Bill 68 to the floor as an order of business of consent calendar, breaking strong Judiciary Committee tradition. Is there any discussion?
Funny guy must be closed.
Have you seen that third reading list? We're never going to get through it. Is there a discussion on his motion? All right, call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative
Kummel? Sacrilege, but aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pugonski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Oh, aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 68 moves to the floor via the consent calendar. Now, you watch, because the judiciary never uses a consent calendar. Someone will think we're trying to be sneaky and probably protest the thing. So, all right, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 69.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 69 is a larger word usage bill from the Oregon Law Commission. Timothy Travis is here to regale the committee with the changes in law in the juvenile code. Basically, juvenile code has its own language, and this would update it so that it's consistent throughout with the terms youth offender, child, and ward. Over the years, it's been difficult to keep all that consistent, and Mr. Travis has gone through the entire code with the Oregon Law Commission and the help of Wendy and everyone else to update that. And there also, Mr. Chairman, is an A2 amendment that Virginia and Timothy have looked at that would take away any conflicts with House Bill 2091, 70, 72, and 2277. It's a conflict amendment, A2 conflict resolves conflicts, A2s.
I'm Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department, here in my usual role of resolving conflicts.
You're a uniter, not a divider.
Uh-huh. I beg your pardon?
You're a uniter, not a divider.
That's correct, yes. And also with the second most simple bill that you will get from the Oregon Law Commission, even though it is quite thick and it doesn't look simple, it really and truly is. The testimony which you've received from the Law Commission is somewhat lengthy. Really what you need to zoom in on is on page 2, section 3, statement of problem, and then section 4, which goes over onto the next page, and then section 5. That's really all I'm going to talk about today. The juvenile code is a very highly technical piece of work. There are words that appear in the juvenile code that don't mean what you think they mean and what don't mean what you will find out that word means in the dictionary. That's because the juvenile code is a compilation, really, of statutes over a long period of time, each of which is sort of the artifact of one fad or another that's gone through juvenile law over the past 50 years. So we end up with words that had very highly technical meanings 30 years ago, but because that particular view of juvenile law is gone, that word remains in the code with just a plain meaning now instead of the hyper-technical meaning that it used to have. It's a big job to go through the juvenile code and to straighten all this out, and Senate Bill 69 is only a small step in that process, and it is a small step which attempts to reconcile the use of the nomenclature we use in the juvenile code for people, for the individuals who are under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court for various reasons. There is a different title, if you will, for each of these people because different statutes apply to them. We have children in the juvenile code. We have youth in the juvenile code. We have youth offenders in the juvenile code. And we have wards of the court. We also have words like juvenile and things like that, which we have taken out. A child under the new system is someone who is alleged to be abused and neglected. Just alleged to be abused and neglected. That makes them like any other person. They are not really under the jurisdiction of the court yet. A ward is a person who has been adjudicated abused and neglected. They are a ward of the court. A youth is a person who is accused of having committed a delinquent act, and a youth offender is a person who has been found to have committed a delinquent act. That's the nomenclature that was adopted pretty much by Senate Bill 1 in 1995, but not all the references in the juvenile code were changed to comply with that nomenclature. That's what this bill does. This bill brings the entire code into compliance with that nomenclature. And it's important that this happen because you cannot say in the code, for example, that this certain statute applies to a child if you're trying to get to a delinquent, because a child is not a delinquent. So that's why it's important that these are all harmonized. Now, you also have in the testimony on page 5, there's a section 11, and this testimony was prepared over on the Senate side when there was a potential problem that the juvenile directors had. And that problem has been resolved. And over on the Senate side, the juvenile directors came in and said that that problem had been resolved. So there is no opposition to this bill. Further on in the testimony, on page 6, you will see a long list going on to the rest of the testimony, which explains what each section change in this bill does. And each section either conforms to the nomenclature that I was talking about, or it makes an editorial change to bring this code into compliance with the editorial conventions that Legislative Council uses today. Because many of these statutes complied with the conventions that Legislative Council used 30 years ago. So you'll see a lot of shells and mays and that kind of stuff that you see all the time. And finally, there are some style changes that the legislature has gone through since some of these statutes were written, and those are changed as well. I would also refer you back to page 2 of the testimony. You will see under section 2, history of the project, you will see a list of all of the people who worked on this project with me. I advise if you ever want to have a work group and have everyone who's a stakeholder in the interest of that work group, if you want to have everyone show up to every meeting, put me in charge of the work group. Because when I'm in charge of the work group, everybody shows up to make sure that I don't do something untoward. I had a lot of supervision in putting this together. And as you can see, there are a lot of names here that you recognize, a lot of very knowledgeable and trusted people in the area of juvenile law. This is their product, not really mine. So if there are any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Tim, the A2s simply, you tell me what the A2s do again.
The A2s are conflict amendments.
Okay.
The juvenile code is not static. There were some amendments to it that were made during this session which did not conform with the language of Senate Bill 69. So what that does is it takes the bills that are passed in this session that did not account for this nomenclature scheme and just applies it to those bills.
Are there questions for Mr. Travis?
Told you it was simple. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Anyone else here on Senate Bill 69? Close the public hearing. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetland.
Senate Bill 69 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
You want to adopt the A2s?
Yes, sorry. Then move the A2s into the bill.
Okay. Representative Shetterly moved the -A2 amendments to Senate Bill 69. Is there any discussion on his motion
Is there any objection? The A2s are in the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
No, I'll move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 69 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Hummel.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative
Kozlowski.
Aye.
Representative
Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Jackson.
Aye.
Vice Jensen.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. Senate Bill 69 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer on the to carry this?
Okay.
All right. Representative Crummell. That's good. All right, we're going to now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 64. And call up Mr. Darris. And Jeanette Holman, you want to come up too? Good to see you, Warren.
Good to see you, Representative. It's been a while.
It has. You want to start?
So my name is Warren Darris. I've been an attorney in private practice in Portland for almost 32 years with a practice emphasizing estate planning and probate. Incidentally, when I late last year shipped the first draft of this bill to the legislative person on the estate planning and administration section asking them to look at it and let me know their position, the response when Mr. Klein called me back was, well, Warren, you know, you're the only lawyer in the state who cares about this stuff, so we're not going to do anything about it. I've been representing the Division of State Lands under a contract with the Department of Justice for the last 5 years, handling S-sheet cases. I've brought with me two documents. The first is a section-by-section analysis of the bill, which I wrote. And by the way, which is not being done on state budget. This is entirely on my time, including my testimony today. I also brought with me a document labeled in the third line as my testimony, but I do want to assure you I don't plan to read this document. But it does lay out my outline and any of the specific sections you want to go into, it will provide the background. For those who are not actively involved in SGEAT, let me just give you the basic context in which we are working. The Oregon Constitution provides that SGEAT properties go to the Common School Fund, but the Oregon Constitution does not define what SGEAT is. SGEAT relates back to a doctrine developed in feudal England, under which, upon the death of a tenant, a vassal, if you will, without heirs, and of course that meant sons back then, the lord succeeded to the property. So if during this hearing I refer to the committee members as your lordship rather than representative, that's why.
Would actually prefer that.
Well, I was sure you did, Mr. Chairman. It is entirely within the power of the legislature to determine what S-cheats, because the legislature clearly has the authority to establish the right to inherit, whether by will or by intestacy, what happens to property in the absence of a will. Currently, Oregon intestacy property provides generally favorably for the spouse or children. If there are no children, everything goes to the parents or descendants of the parents. If there are no parents or descendants of the parents, then everything goes to the grandparents or descendants of the grandparents, and that's fairly typical of the law of intestate succession in the United States, although many states actually go further to the great-grandparents and the great-great-grandparents. The Oregon laws governing heirship and generally the current Oregon probate code were adopted in 1969, and many of the provisions in this bill before you today relate to problems arising out of the 1969 probate code in two areas. The first area is uncertainty with regard to the role of the Division of State Lands, which administers SG property, both during and before probate. And the second is the difficulty in calculating the shares of heirs under the 1969 probate code. Before 1969, Oregon had indefinite intestacy. You know, no grandparents or descendants, you went to the great-grandparents. But the Oregon code provided that in the absence of a will, in the absence of spouse and children, the estate was divided equally among the nearest of kin. That meant that if you had a cousin who would inherit and three or four cousins who had died, leaving children, your cousins once removed, those children were out in the cold. In the 1969 probate code revision, the concept of the right of representation was added for those collateral heirs. Collateral heirs are the descendants of your ancestors, other than yourself and your descendants. And that greatly complicated the determination of heirship. Instead of having one or two cousins, for those cases where the only child never married, never had children, you may have one or two cousins and 10 or 15 cousins once removed. And you may find it impossible to locate all of those people. And if you can't locate all of those people, many times you cannot figure out the shares of those that you can locate. Let me give you an example of an estate we have open right now, the Sarah Mary Miller Estate in Washington County. She was the child of her father by his second marriage. By his first marriage, he had three children. We have one of those who left, I think it's nine known great-grandchildren who are heirs. We have another of those born in 1876 that we simply cannot determine what happened to her. Without knowing what happened to her under the present code, we cannot determine the size of the shares of those that we know about, because we don't know the level at which division occurs. We don't know if she left children who are surviving or who were surviving at the time that Sarah Mary Miller died. So the bill would correct that problem. Beginning on page 3 of my testimony, I run through the specific things that the bill does. First, it clarifies the pre-administration role of the Division of State Lands. A lot can and should happen between the date a decedent dies and the date a personal representative is appointed for the estate. At times, several weeks pass. The Division of State Lands, when there's no will and no known heirs, steps into the breach to protect the property, to find heirs, to find a will. Most of the time, we succeed. But our authority to step in those situations is not very clear in the law, and our authority to recover our costs for stepping in those situations is not all clear in the law. We request payment. Most of the time we are reimbursed for our expenses, in those cases voluntarily, but my letter requesting reimbursement is always a request, never a demand. So the statute not only clarifies our authority in the pre-administration or pre-probate situation, but it clarifies our authority to be compensated for those. Second, the bill allows DSL, the Division of State Lands, to act in partial SG situations where we have found some of the heirs or some of the devisees, but not all of them. The current practice is that once one heir is found, the Division of State Lands withdraws and allows that heir to handle the estate. The practical problem with that is, particularly in smaller estates, sometimes the heirs just aren't interested in doing what needs to be done, and there is still an interest of the Common School Fund to protect until all of the heirs are identified. I would point out that the commentary to the 1969 code does strongly suggest that it was intended that the Division of State Lands have power to act in those cases, but the code itself does not at all clearly reflect that, and most attorneys who do not practice in this area are simply not going to pick up on the fact that the Division of State Lands has an important interest and should get notice. So the next point is the bill does assure that the Division of State Lands does get notice in partial SG to states so that it can step forward and protect the interest of the Common School Fund, which does receive the shares of heirs who are missing, and also to protect the interest of missing heirs. I would point out that the resources of the Division of State Lands are limited, and it is not the intent or expectation of this bill that the Division of State Lands is going to demand control of every estate where there is one distant cousin missing. But there are some estates where it is important that somebody in a position be in a position to step forward and protect the interest of missing heirs and protect the interest of the Common School Fund. Next, it's just a practical administration problem. The statute specifies that the director of the Division of State Lands is personal representative in estates where there is no heir and no will. Also, the director of the Division of State Lands is specified to be the person who signs small estate affidavits. I've had to advise the division that much of that function is not delegable. So the director has to sign a lot of papers reflecting the performance of function by division of staff in which she has no personal knowledge. And this would simply allow the director to appoint estate administrators, that's already a position within the Division of State Land, to perform this function, much like a bank has trust officers to perform that function. Next point is, under the current statute, only the director of the Division of State Lands can serve as personal representative for an estate when there's no will and no known heirs. Under the small estate law, which is enacted after 1969, the director can permit a creditor to file a small estate affidavit. Why would we do that? We do that in insolvent estates. If the estate's insolvent, it's the creditors who care about the estate. The Division of State Lands really has no interest. The bill would allow us to do the same thing in full probates. If we determine that the estate's insolvent or based on administrative rules, you know, I would certainly suggest the division be looking at a rule to delegate administration to private administrators in Eastern Oregon, where it's just not economical to send people from Salem to handle moderate-sized estates. So it would allow us to always, in insolvent estates, let the creditors take over by rule in any other kind of estate where we determine it's more economical to let somebody else administer the estate. The next point in the bill is to change the starting time on the time limit for the recovery of escheat funds by administrative proceedings. After an estate escheats, after property escheats, the statute provides for a 10-year period for administrative proceedings for the heirs to come forward and recover those funds. Oregon law greatly favors the heirs over escheat. The problem is, since and right now the 10-year period begins to run on the date of the court order of escheat. The problem is that since 1969, when all escheats began with the court order, we've added the small estate law, in which there is no court order, and we've added affidavits to banks and financial institutions, in which there is no court order. So no one can come in those administrative in those cases, small estates or affidavit transfers to the Division of State Lands and say that they're filing their petition within the requisite 10-year period from the order because there hasn't been an order. And so what we would do would be to allow that period to run from the date of death. At the request of some heirship search firms, there's a backup provision saying that they also get at least 8 years from the date of the order in cases in which there is an order. So that lengthy period would still be preserved in cases where probate was delayed. But we now, every decedent's got a date of death, so we have a uniform date that will work for every kind of SG. We're going to allow under this bill heirs to recover escheated property in administrative proceedings, even if they were aware of the proceeding. Under current law, one of the things you have to say if you want to bring one of those administrative proceedings is that you were not aware of the order that escheated the property. The problem with that is that many times people who are aware of the procedure simply cannot, based on the information currently available, prove that they are heirs. And so they want to keep the probate proceedings open forever because they know that once the court order is entered, they're out in the cold. And so what we have to do, and let me give you an example of a case like that. We've got one open right now in Yamhill County, in which the decedent's mother abandoned the family, and the decedent was then adopted by his mother's parents, and therefore he became his mother's sister in the eyes of the law. And she ran off with her new boyfriend and had three more children, who are, in the eyes of the law, our decedent's nieces and nephews. Actually, they're half-siblings by blood. Well, 1968, Mom disappeared from the face of the earth. The three children don't know where she is. We have not been able to find her. We have not been able to have a clue. She is the sole heir. She cuts off those three children who would inherit if she's predeceased. This bill would allow those children to come forward within the 10-year period if they can find evidence that she had predeceased. It wouldn't be fair to cut them off, and at the same time, it wouldn't be reasonable to hold the probate open indefinitely to allow them to determine what happened to their mother. A very dysfunctional family, by the way. I haven't given you all the information about that family.
I'll talk to Representative Krummel afterwards. He's working on a screenplay.
Next point. Right now, there are various presumptions established by common law as to when we can presume somebody dead. For example, if somebody would be over 100 years old, we can presume they're dead. If somebody was last seen boarding the Titanic, or the new definition, somebody was last seen entering the World Trade Center on September 11th, we can, by case law, presume they're dead. The bill would codify that existing case law and would add a significant presumption. And that presumption is that the person who disappeared in circumstances where they might have had kids had two children. That way, it's utterly arbitrary, but a lot of escheat is utterly arbitrary. That way, we can calculate everyone's shares under the right of representation system, which under the present law, in a case like the Sarah Mary Miller case that I described earlier, we simply cannot do. And by the way, the Miller case just last week settled it based on the family that we did find agreeing that we would presume there were two children of the missing sister so that the state will get 2/7 and the balance will escheat. And by the way, also as part of the settlement, we agreed that we'd ignore the requirement that or we would treat them as having no knowledge of the order, even though we know they do, so they'll have the 10 years to come forward. In other words, what I'm proposing here today is the same thing that we have successfully proposed to settle these impossible cases in the past. The last point, the last change made in the bill, and this has been really softened by amendment compared to the way we began in the Senate, is to require better identification of collateral heirs in probate petitions. Frankly, the level of practice in this regard in the state of Oregon in many cases is pretty poor, and the objective is simply to focus attorneys' attention on thinking about who the heirs are, so that they don't wind up in a situation, as the case I just got after the client fired the attorney when, upon discovering this problem, we have to keep the estate open for another 4 months because the attorney never gave notice to nieces and nephews, since, after all, the estate was going to brothers and sisters, and who cared about the nieces and nephews by those two brothers and sisters who had already died. In the Senate, there were two provisions of the bill that generated significant discussion, and those provisions have both been removed. So I'm not going to discuss those here today. I wrote this bill to some degree based on frustrations of representing the Division of State Lands. At the Senate hearing, Ms. Holman came forward and endorsed it, hopefully not the kiss of death, as a Division of State Lands supported bill. And I think it's good for the division. I think it's good for the law in this area. And I urge the committee to adopt it.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Darris?
Mr. Chair?
Lord McPherson?
Thank you, Your Lordship. Mr. Darris, this is not my area of law practice, although I butt up against it at times with issues in my area of expertise. I see in the background description that it refers to the escheat rules generally in, I think, not necessarily in Oregon, but maybe elsewhere as well. Providing for property to pass to first-line collaterals, that is, descendants of grandparents. So that would mean people who are cousins of the decedent, first cousins, mm-hmm. sort of normal, kind of uncomplicated kind of family tree that most of us have experienced, would have a right to claim property, but the other more distant cousins would not. That is, people who are descendants of great-grandparents.
Yeah, and that's existing law.
And is that a universal standard in Oregon and elsewhere?
It used to be universal that you went indefinitely. You know, if you couldn't find anybody from the grandparents, you'd go to the great-grandparents. California still goes two generations above the grandparents. Hmm. About, from what I've read, about 50% of the jurisdictions in the United States limited it to grandparents and their descendants or spouses.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do any have a more restricted approach to who has a claim to otherwise unclaimed property before it escheats?
No, actually, that was one of our proposals in the Senate that didn't make it out of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
And would it have made it more, to what extent would that have been consistent with any other states, or would we be in the forefront in that respect?
We would have been in the forefront.
Okay. This is more maybe a comment, Mr. Chair, rather than a question, although I certainly invite by a reaction. One of the things about this sort of general area of activity that strikes me is that we have a much more connected society in which we take collective responsibility for each other's needs, and that in that setting, I think that more antiquated notions of property rights may need to be adjusted in relation to the appropriate interest of the state to receive property that's left unclaimed or for which there's not a very close familial relationship. So I would say if there were any thought among my colleagues that they wanted to go back in more in the direction that Mr. Darris had suggested on the Senate side, it's something that I would be open to.
Yeah. If I could give you a specific example of the kind of case you're talking about, one we have open right now, our decedent born in 1922, this is a $400,000 estate, and we're talking millions of dollars a year in these estates to cousins. Our decedent born in 1922 in Portland. Both of her parents were in their 40s. She was an only child. Her parents were from England. I have, through the online 1881 and 1901 censuses of Great Britain, established that our decedent had 7 maternal aunts and uncles and 7 paternal aunts and uncles. the descendants of these aunts and uncles, the youngest of whom was born in 1886, are the heirs of this estate. I would expect there will be between 50 and 100 of them. Every indication we have is that the decedent had no connection with her family in England. And in fact, I noticed that her father changed his name when he moved to this country, and possibly there was a reason for that. This is not unusual that I'm notifying people that they're going to receive very large sums of money from Oregonians who are total strangers to them.
Mr. Darris, some of us pray for that every night.
That was the reaction I got on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I can't tell you how often when that doorbell rings, I hope it's a telegram. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Your Excellency. I'm a little bit confused on the background information also. This is on the staff measure summary that was given to us, by the way. But it refers to, on about the third line from the bottom, it refers to the receipt of such property by laughing heirs. And I'm trying to figure out what a laughing heir is. Is that the one that's laughing on his way to the
telegram?
That's the one, okay.
I've talked to a number of those. And by the way, the literature and my experience with so-called laughing heirs is that more likely they're guilty heirs. They know they're not entitled by any moral sense to what they're getting. Some of them are pretty hysterical, but most of them are saying, really? Me? Who?
So a laughing heir would be one that really does not really have a claim to the estate,
It's somebody who's related by blood, but never knew the decedent well enough to be mourning his or her death.
Okay. Thank you.
Further discussions? Ms. Holman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here just to hopefully not put the kiss of death on this bill. The Division of State Lands wholeheartedly supports this bill. We supported the Senate version because we figured it would bring in between $3 and $5 million a year to the Common School Fund, which was a significant hunk of money. But as Warren hasn't talked about those provisions, I'm not going to go into them anymore either. We also support it strongly because of the changes to the administration that this would give to make for a more streamlined process for the division and to make it clear what our authorities are. It will be very, very helpful to the division in our administration of the estates. And with that, I think I forgot to identify myself for the record. I'm Jeanette Holman, the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Are there questions for Ms. Holman? All right. Thank you both very much. If there aren't any other questions. Anyone else here signed up on Senate Bill 64A? All right. We are going to close the public hearing. We're going to open the work session. And by the way, I'm going to ask the bar that we get some extra CLE credit for Mr. Darris's testimony.
Thank you very much.
So, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Prozanski.
I'll move Senate Bill 64 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Prozanski moves Senate Bill 64 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? All right, Ann, call the roll.
Representative Barford?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative
Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Prozanski?
Aye.
Representative Kennedy?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 64 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson, are you interested in carrying this?
Sure.
All right. Okay, we're now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 609.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 609 comes from the Senate, obviously, and was introduced, as I understand it, by Senator Kate Brown. And it involves changing the securities law slightly to make it so that somebody who not just sells securities but offers securities can be held liable if they act fraudulently. Specifically, it was my understanding that there's some difficulty with PERS and other large security purchasers. When they buy directly from a company, they can then sue the company if somehow the representations were fraudulent. But if there's a broker involved, there's some confusion as to what liability the broker can have.
And I have signed up Fred Boss, Scott Shore, Floyd
Lanter.
Lanter, is that how you pronounce it? Floyd, okay. And then we always welcome Ms. Richardson to the committee. Who wants to lead off? Is that going to be you, Mr. Boss, or are you?
Please, Mr. Shore.
Mr. Shore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Scott Shore. I'd like to state for the record, this is not a laughing air matter. This is a securities bill. I've been a practicing securities lawyer in Portland, Oregon for the past 7 years at the law firm of Stoll, Stoll, Byrne, Lochte, and Schlachter. I'm here to testify today in support of Senate Bill 609. I should say, by way of disclosure, I also have on occasion served as a special assistant attorney general under Mr. Boss's supervision in bringing cases on behalf of OPERS and state funds against corporations that commit fraud. And it is with that background that I think our firm became interested in the issue and why I'm here today. Senate Bill 609 clarifies and extends the Oregon Securities Law, which is in Chapter 59 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, to provide the same minimum recourse that's available under the federal securities laws. As I mentioned, the primary beneficiaries of extending the law are the Oregon Public Employee Retirement System, OPERS, and other state funds that purchase securities. It could be any state fund, including the Common School Fund. Currently, OPERS may not be able to bring a claim under the Oregon Securities Law against a corporation that commits fraud, such as Enron, unless OPERS purchases the security directly from Enron or whatever corporation it is, for instance, in an offering or through some other direct transaction. The new proposed statutory section would permit OPERS to bring a claim if it purchased securities in the open market where most securities are purchased. OPERS would be able to bring a claim in state court in Oregon and have an Oregon jury decide its claim, as would other state funds. Currently, there's some conflicting case law interpreting ORS 59.115. Some cases hold that an investor, any investor, may only state a claim against a fraudulent corporation if the investor purchased the security directly from the company. There's some other cases that hold as long as the corporation solicited the investor to purchase the security, that's sufficient. Again, SB 609 or Senate Bill 609 clarifies and extends the Oregon securities law to allow any investor damaged by fraud to recover its or his or her losses when the investor purchased the security in the open market. The amendment would allow for the so-called fraud on the market type claims and would make Oregon law consistent with the corresponding federal statute that allows for such claims. With one minor exception, and that's an amendment that I believe is in your hands that was completed by the Legislative Council. This was passed unanimously out of the Senate. The exception is this minor amendment to ORS 59.335 that, due to an oversight in our drafting process, was not voted on by the Senate. I'll explain that minor amendment. ORS 59.335 can be read to provide that a person must make an offer or sale to an investor in Oregon in order to be liable under ORS 59.135. Because Senate Bill 609 amends the law and clarifies it to allow a claim against a corporation that commits fraud whether or not there is an offer or sale, the proposed amendment deletes the now unnecessary references in ORS 59.335 to the primary fraud section in ORS 59.135. There are also two less significant amendments that I'll briefly describe. SB 609 or Senate Bill 609 restores ORS 59.1151 to allow for liability for fraudulent sales of so-called federally covered securities, and most securities come under federally covered securities. Those are securities traded on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. The legislature had amended that statute in 1997 intending to eliminate certain licensing requirements for federally covered securities. There was a national act that pretty much brought within exclusive federal control the licensing of brokers and dealers, and that amendment by the 1997 legislature was intended to eliminate state regulation of that type of licensing situation. It was not intended, and the past enforcement director of the Securities Division has told our firm and has stated, acknowledged that the prior amendment was not intended to eliminate liability if there's fraud in connection with federally covered securities. There's been no objection to that portion from the private securities industry. The mutual fund industry had one minor tweaking that was resolved in the Senate before the committee there, and we worked that out. And as far as I'm aware, there are no objections to restoring ORS 59.115 to allow for liability for fraudulent sales of federally covered securities. Finally, Senate Bill 609 restores the word offers to ORS 59.115. This word was eliminated many, many legislatures ago as a superfluous and unnecessary. Some courts have said that eliminating the word offer from that particular statutory section made the securities law narrower than the federal law. Restoring the word offer eliminates that disparity because it's not a superfluous word for that section. We are currently aware of no objections to Senate Bill 609. I believe there are a number of state agencies who are here to support it to the extent it helps the state agencies and state funds, and therefore we respectfully request that the House Judiciary Committee pass Senate Bill 609 onto the full House with the amendment I referred to before with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Shore. Mr. Boss, are you up next, or are we going to go to Mr. Ladner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a short statement. Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, the Department of Justice supports expanding the ability to recover for losses caused by fraud for state entities that may invest state funds in securities to the broadest possible extent. We take no position on this bill as it relates to any other entities other than the state entities. And like others, I forgot to identify myself, and I apologize. My name is Fred Boss. I am Assistant Attorney General. I am also Chief Counsel for the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Boss. Mr. Lanter?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, a member of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The division is charged in part with enforcing the securities law in Oregon and regulating the securities industry in Oregon. In general, we agree with the sponsors of this bill that investors should be able to bring suits to recover their losses not only from the company that issued the stock or the person who had title to the investment, but also from those individuals who facilitate and promote the stock sale and who make their living through sales commissions. We also believe that investors should have the right to bring so-called fraud on the market lawsuits when they buy stock on the open market in reliance on financial statements and similar information that turns out to have been fraudulent. We worked with the sponsors of the bill to ensure that the Oregon security law remains reasonably in line with those in other states so as not to discourage investment in the formation of capital in Oregon, and to ensure that the bill language does not create any technical problems for enforcement by the securities laws by the division. The latest amendment to the bill, removing references to 59.135, which is our fraud statute, in subsections 1 and 2, serves to ensure that misrepresentations by third parties designed to encourage the purchase or sale of investments will be actionable in Oregon. The legislature, by removing the references to 59.135 and section 59.335, will expand the anti-fraud remedies available in Oregon. With that understanding, we support Senate Bill 609 as amended and respectfully request that the committee send it to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lander. Ms. Richardson.
For the record, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff, Oregon State Treasury, and I'm here on behalf of the State Treasurer to register his support for Senate Bill 609. As you know from our prior appearance, the Oregon Investment Council, the Treasury, and the Attorney General's Office does do all pursue recovery for losses to state-managed funds, such as the PERS fund, where recovery options are available. And this bill would aid us in those recovery efforts. Presently, we're unable to bring certain cases in state court in Oregon. Right now, we have a case necessarily filed in California to take advantage of that state securities laws, and that adds expense and inconvenience and ultimately could limit recovery. So the Treasurer would ask for your support of this bill to help us in any way we can.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
I'm not sure who to direct this to. Maybe to Scott, and you could defer to others if need be. But would the remedies that are made available by this bill extend to the accounting firms that have been rendering what we've learned here in, over the last year or two were at least inaccurate, one might suspect fraudulent characterizations of the financial condition of public companies?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson. I believe it would, because it extends not only the issuer, but persons who participate or materially aid in fraud. So under the federal law, and I can't imagine anything but any interpretation under the state law, would be that accountants who participate in the fraud would similarly be liable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 609? Okay, I'll close the public hearing. We won't be going to work session today on Senate Bill 609. So we'll move down the agenda to Senate Bill 41, and I'll open the work session on Senate Bill 41.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 41, if you recall, we heard, I believe, last week, and essentially deals with the situation where parties are fighting over the a contract. And one of the defenses is that the contract is void, but the contract also includes an attorney's fees provision. If the contract were to be found void, the prevailing party could still collect attorney's fees based on that provision, even though the contract is found void and the provision that we're talking about is in that now void contract. There are amendments that you should have before you. Last time we heard the bill, there were some concerns addressed about including in the scope of this measure real estate contracts, and I believe that's what the amendments address. And I see Ms. Graby in the audience. I don't know if we've reached out, gotten rid of all the opposition on the bill.
Well, let me say this, colleagues. You'll recall that we had Mr. Fuller from the auto dealers. You should have a letter in your file indicating that they do not have any opposition to the bill. They got clarification on it. I don't see NFIB. They no longer have any opposition to the bill. Come on up, Susan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Susan Gravy with Oregon State Bar, and I talked to J.L. Wilson the other day, and my understanding is he said, you can just put my name on the bottom of that same letter. They no longer have concerns.
Okay, thank you. I still see our friends from AOI and the realtors here in the room, which leads me to believe that they still may have an interest in the bill. Am I right about that? Come on up. Come on up.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crummell.
While they're coming up, if I may, what has miraculously occurred with this bill that has removed all of these people's objections?
They read it.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's about it.
That's a novel concept.
Okay. Tell us what still concerns you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. Our concerns with the bill would go away if the -3 amendments were incorporated into the bill. You should have those before you, and we do appreciate the bar having those drafted to alleviate our concerns.
What's the difference between the -2 and the -3?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Crummell, the -2 twos, if you look at the very last few words, said residential real estate contract. The dash threes removed that, so now it would be applicable, the exception would be applicable to all real estate contracts, whether residential or commercial.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Chair. I still can't support the dash threes. Again, if you recall the scenario, and I think most contracts for the sale of real estate still are residential property, whether the amendment identifies them or lifts them out or not. But the scenario, again, is that a purchaser buys the property, discovers that fraud has been committed, and then, let's say, quits paying on the contract, is sued for foreclosure of the contract, and as part of that suit for foreclosure, the plaintiff, the seller, asks for attorney fees. The buyer responds to the defense and says this contract was should be rescinded because it was fraudulent and I should get my money back. If the buyer wins, the buyer doesn't get their attorney fees, even though the seller could have gotten their attorney fees if the seller could have prevailed. And I just, to me, there's a real inequity there, and I don't know why we would want to do that to purchasers of real estate.
Okay. Representative Ackerman.
I also can't support the dash threes. For that reason and for the further reason that a commercial litigant could also prevail on this theory and have their attorney's fees paid by the other side. So this cuts both ways and evens the playing field in litigation where you have a attorney's fees provision in the contract.
All right. Anybody else have questions or comments that they want to make while we've got Harlan here?
Ms. Chair, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. We agreed to work with the proponents of this bill. They got us the information that we needed to ship to our membership, the broader membership, just this week. It was going out in the leading issues, which I think you all receive. My best attempt at explaining the pro and con side of the bill, and that just goes out tonight. I did have a lot of conversations with a variety of attorneys who are members of AOI, and I don't think I could pass a contracts class yet, but I feel like I'm getting there. So we, you know, if the bill goes out today, we will just kind of say it, we won't have much objection because we haven't gotten a lot of feedback because we just got the information from the proponents. But I haven't heard any huge objection to those people that I have shopped it with.
Okay. Anybody else? All right. You guys can go now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Barb, want to say anything? Do you have anything else to add? You want to come up?
Sure. Michael Zusman on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. We are willing to accept these amendments. Obviously, our preference is that it apply universally, but as I think I testified last time, we'd rather see this thing pass. Rather a half a loaf than no loaf at all. We think as broad as it can be and gain support is good for the law in the state of Oregon and the certainty of contracts.
Okay. Are there questions for Mr. Zusman?
Want a motion?
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly. What this is saying is that irrespective of what a contract says, if a person makes a claim against another person for a breach of a contract, the prevailing party, whoever the prevailing party is going to get their attorney's fees as part of the settlement.
Actually, ORS 20.096 already says that. What's happened is that there's been some judge-made law that has carved out an exception to what I will call universal reciprocity, which means whoever wins gets their attorney's fees under a prevailing party attorney's fees clause in a contract. There have been a couple of cases out of the Oregon Supreme Court that have specifically said, we know the statute's there, but if there's been a rescission of the contract, we're not going to let the successful rescinding party get the benefit of the attorney's fees clause. So the goal of this legislation is to do nothing more than restore full reciprocity that the legislature originally intended back in the 1970s when it passed 20.096.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, that would only be the case if there is a prevailing party attorney's fees clause in the contract. Many contracts, you know, don't have any clause with respect to attorney's fees, and in that case, this wouldn't apply. So it's not that any contract, the prevailing party will get attorney's fees. That would only be true under this law if the contract said somewhere in its terms a party can get their attorney's fees. And even if the contract says the if it's a seller and a buyer of a product, that the seller can get their attorney's fees if they have to enforce the contract against the buyer. Oregon law currently says that provision, even though it says only the seller, must be reciprocal, so that even if it says the seller gets their attorney's fees and the buyer, if the buyer wins, you would think that they wouldn't get their attorney's fees. Oregon law says that provision is reciprocal and they would get their attorney's fees. Now, under current Oregon law, there's a question as to if the buyer says, hey, we didn't have a contract at all in the first place because you forged my signature on the contract, and they win on that argument. Under current Oregon law, there's some question as to whether they could get their attorney's fees, because now there is no contract. And this measure would say, yes, under that situation, the buyer who is successful in proving that there wasn't a contract at all can still get their attorney's fees in that case, because there is that clause in the contract. If the seller had won that case and said, oh, we do have a contract because you stood here and signed it, they would have gotten their attorney's fees. And so there's an unfairness seen as when you defend in part on the ground that there isn't a contract, you are now risking whether you would get your attorney's fees without this measure being passed.
Okay.
Does that help at all? And it gets kind of complicated with that reciprocal nature, but
it does. I think I'm understanding. I just want to make sure that I'm reading it correctly. So it really is putting in the reciprocity for both parties,
right?
So that the prevailing party, if in a contract there is a prevailing party clause.
I mean, imagine a situation, Representative Crummell, where you had entered into a contract with someone, and let's use the real estate example because it's fresh, to buy a piece of real estate that was alleged to have been a certain size. And when you find out that you were defrauded in what the size was, you challenge your ability to pay under the contract and say, I don't have to pay. I entered into that contract only by fraud and inducement, and I shouldn't have to honor the contract. And there's an attorney's fees provision, and they say, no, you knew exactly what you were buying, and you go to battle over that. Without this statute, what it would mean is that if you lost your case, and in fact they said there is in fact a contract, and you knew what you were getting, and you weren't fraudulently induced to enter into it, you would then be obligated to pay the seller's attorney's fees under the nature of the contract.
Right.
But without this statute, the argument is if you prevail, and there was no contract, and they say you don't have to get the contract, you would not be able to turn around and say, well, the person who was trying to enforce the contract ought to have to pay my attorney's fees.
I see.
Because their response would be, well, you know, the contract was deemed void, so I don't have to pay. I don't have to pay the attorney's fees, because if the contract's void, it's void, and that includes void as to the attorney's fees provision. So what this means is that either side still gets their opportunity to get attorney's fees when they're trying to enforce the contract.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Yeah, you know, when you think of it that way, really, without this reciprocity, you're rewarding the bad actor, because they can go into a suit like this. If they win, they recover their attorney fees. If they don't win, and it proves that they committed fraud and they were bad and evil, you eat your own attorney fees. They don't have to pay your attorney fees. So we really are rewarding the bad actor by not having this reciprocity.
Well, and I guess I would just say that the bad actor concept I think does work in a fraud case. What I would say is that it does seem odd that when someone has been trying to enforce the validity of a contract and saying it's valid, to be able to have them immediately then turn around and walk away from the provision of the contract that says you would have gotten attorney's fees. I mean, it just seems upside down to me. But
Mr. Chairman,
Representative or Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry if I'm getting in front of somebody. One of the curious things to me is that I've encountered this in litigation, and this question regarding reciprocity often tilts the balance of the case in favor of one side or the other, and the attorney's fees provision becomes this huge hammer overhanging one side's defense or tactic towards the case. And one of the most curious things is I think that if this bill were to pass and the parties who are in opposition or wavering see it in operation, I would think that next session they would come back and want to be, like the realtors, for instance, be included in this, because it really does benefit all the parties, and it's hard to think of all the fact situations where this would arise, but it truly is a very reciprocal provision, and I think that once everybody understood how it would work, everybody would want to take advantage of it. I can't think of a situation that a party would want to not take advantage of this unless they were acting, they were the bad actor, and obviously those people aren't going to be here.
Go ahead.
Chair Williams, members of the committee. You know, I on the trip down here, I actually was sitting here thinking of some hypotheticals. I just want to emphasize, beyond the simple fraud example, excuse me, this bill, frankly, is good for business in that it provides certainty in commercial transactions. I jotted down hypotheticals. I know it's late, and I'm not planning to go into them unless somebody really wants me to. But there are plenty of business-to-business transactions, probably more business-to-business transactions than possibly consumer transactions, where the application of this bill would provide certainty when litigation does arise in a contract where there is an attorney's fees clause.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm still kind of struggling through some of these things in my own mind. I think that what I'm going to do is that I'm going to not support the bill here today. But I think that, it appears as though it will probably go to the floor anyway, and it gives me an opportunity to kind of work through some other things in my own mind. And if I do that, and when I do that, I may very well change my vote on the floor to a yes. But I think for purposes of trying to rectify in my own mind the issue, I understand the issue of reciprocity and what the bill is trying to get at in that respect. I just haven't resolved in my own mind the fairness issue, and so.
And that's fine. And perhaps some of the on a one-on-one with Mr. Zusman or from the bar, some additional hypotheticals may or may not resolve some of the
right. Yeah, and that's what I'm thinking.
Okay, that's fine. All right, Representative. Representative Anderson.
Was that discussion or?
No, that was discussion. There isn't a motion yet.
I would like a little further explanation of why the realtors would not like to see the residential use in there.
Well, maybe I can do it, Harlan. I think by striking the word residential, I think what the dash threes do is it applies to everything. So residential was actually a narrowing. So it would have applied only to residential but not to commercial-type real estate transactions. And by striking residential and just going to a contract for the sale of real estate, it applies to all.
It exempts. It exempts.
Yeah, it exempts it. The amendment applies. The amendment would apply. So it was
to everyone.
Yeah, it was a broadening of the exemption, whereas with just the word residential, it would have narrowed the exemption solely to residential transactions. Does that clarify for you? Mm-hmm. Did I get it right, Harlan?
Can I just add
something? Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Representative Anderson. Yes, our concern was that this would lead to more claims for rescission of contracts, and in real estate, that's not a good thing. So the draft dash two amendments applied to exempt real estate contracts that were of a residential nature. The dash 3 exempts all real estate contracts, and we felt that the our fear, our concern that this would lead to more suits to rescission of contracts was true both in the residential as well as in the commercial field. So in order for us to remain neutral on the bill, we would want to see all real estate contracts exempted from the parameters of this bill.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
just before the motion, and Harlan, I just don't agree with that because, again, if you're going to be the plaintiff in a rescission suit, and if you lose, you're going to pay the other side's attorney fees. You've already got that risk. If you're defending, you're not the one that filed the suit. You're already in it because somebody else sued you for foreclosure. So this is not going to create any more suits for rescission because right now, already, if you sue to rescind a contract and the other side then sues to enforce the contract as a matter of the defense, you're going to get stuck with their attorney fees. So I just don't see this as leading to the cost benefit, the risk calculus, I think, is the same under this suit as it is under current law. The risks are still going to be there for the party who would rescind, because if they lose, they're going to pay.
If I might add, Mr. Chairman, I have had the situation in a real estate dispute, and I'm trying to work off your hypothetical, where the party who would normally be able to take advantage of the provision for attorney's fees defends a case on the grounds that there is a contract, as an affirmative defense, loses. So they're not suing you. The defendant says there is a contract. They lose on that affirmative defense, and the judge wants to enforce attorney's fees against them because they raised an affirmative defense that they lost on, that there was a contract. So in other words, they've lost. There is no contract. They were defending on an affirmative defense, and then the judge says, well, you were the one who brought this issue forward, so now you are going to pay attorney's fees because it engendered more litigation than would have otherwise been there. And judges get very confused, I've found, especially in arbitrations, where these defenses get raised, and then they try and figure out, well, you lost on this defense, you won on this defense, and you kind of hash out the different claims, and then they try and figure out, well, where should you get attorney's fees and how much, and this would eliminate all that confusion.
Mr. Right. Chair?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative
I'm sorry.
Anderson was done.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll move Senate Bill 41 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 41 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Other discussion? Let's go to the vote.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Trumbull?
No.
Representative Pazanski?
Aye.
Representative
Kazanski? Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 41 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Can I ask Representative Shetterly to carry the bill?
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 259. Mr. Powell, do you want to come up and say anything about Senate Bill 259 before you leave? Are you sure? You know, Mr. Powell, at some point we're going to make you come up and talk to this committee. You understand that?
All right.
That's John Powell's son.
Oh.
And he sat in the back of the hearing here, in this hearing room, the entire session, and has never said a word. And so at some point I'm going to drag him up here just to talk.
We should arrange that.
Senate Bill 259, colleagues, you'll require, this is a bill involving inspection of public records that a person knows relates to a claim against a public body. We have Mr. Landauer here. Do you want to come forward? Do you want to take a minute and just refresh the committee?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. Senate Bill 259 comes to the committee at the request of the City of Portland. Essentially, what we are attempting to do is extend a current law that applies to the state to other public bodies. That law, 192.420, requires that when the state is being has been notified of being sued or is in active litigation with somebody, and the party suing the state requests public records related to the litigation, that the Attorney General's office be notified of that public record request. We are simply asking for that same provision to extend to local public bodies because, by inference, because it only applies to the state, it excludes public bodies. The result of this will be that anybody who is suing or has filed a notification of suit against a public body and makes a public records request related to the litigation will provide a copy of the public records request to the attorney representing that public body.
Questions?
So it would be the city attorney that gets the that gets a copy of the request for public information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that is correct.
Port County Council. Okay, thank you.
And I just
Representative Barker.
And all this does is just notify the city attorney that that's the information that somebody who's suing him has gathered. So that you apparently Salahid would be prepared to answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, all that the law would require if it were passed would require that the person making the request notify the attorney representing that public body what the nature of the request is. It does not require that the attorney provide the records to the litigant or the requester. It just gives an opportunity for all attorneys to play on a level playing field to know what information is being what information is out there.
All right. Anybody else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Mark, when I look at the language in the bill, it says attorney for the public body where a claim is in active litigation and there's an attorney of record who is outside counsel. Wouldn't that language be satisfied by notice given to the attorney of record in the lawsuit?
I apologize. Could you direct me to the line that you're referring to, Representative?
Attorney for the published body.
And at the same time to the attorney for the public body.
Right, right. I mean, the question is, in the nature of trying to make what I think may be appropriate history for the bill, there was in response to the question earlier, you said that it would be the city attorney, and my reading of the bill language would be that if there were a lawsuit against the city of Portland, for example, and if, for example, Stoll Reeves were representing them, there would be the attorney at Stoll Reeves would be, that notice would be sufficient to come within the statute.
That is correct.
Yes, I think whoever the attorney, I assume whoever the attorney of record is for the purposes of the civil judicial proceeding that's referenced on line 8 of the bill would be the sufficient recipient of the notice. I mean, ultimately the point you're trying to make with this bill, Mark, is that if someone is in the middle of a civil proceeding and at the same time trying to use a Freedom of Information Act type public records request to get information, that the person representing the government entity have knowledge that there is another request for documents going on in this process that they are aware of, so that they're not having sort of two different discovery issues pending in the same case.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. I mean, certainly there are public bodies that simply do not have the resources to have a full-time attorney on staff and then do hire outside counsel to represent them in instances when they are being sued. So that is clearly the intent of what we're trying to do here.
And so this doesn't sound like a paid announcement for Stoll Reeves. That could be, oh, I don't know, say Miller Nash or Shetterly or an IRIC or Ackerman.
You are the city attorneys.
The name of your firm, Bob?
Excuse me?
What's the name of your law firm?
Robert Ackerman.
Robert Ackerman. I mean, so there could be any other.
All fine.
Just as examples.
Mr. Chairman, would Bullivant Hauser Bailey be included?
I don't think so.
No way.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, so, actually, that does lead to a question then. It's not so much an issue in Dallas, but in Portland, Salem, some of your larger communities, you're going to have city attorney, and litigation is typically going to be done with outside counsel.
Is there enough of a connection, communication between outside counsel and your in-house city attorney so that if the notice is served on the city attorney while there's litigation, the city attorney's office is even going to know what this is about? Do we want to make this so where we're talking about a civil judicial proceeding that's pending to which someone is a party? Do we want to make this specific that they be served on the attorney of record in the proceeding? I guess it's here, like you see in Dallas, I don't think that'd be a problem. I don't know about Portland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, it's interesting that you raise that question because that was a question that was raised on the other side of the building. We made a commitment during the discussion of this bill that we would set in motion an internal process to be sure that the notification, at least at the City of Portland, will be given to the head of our torts division, and they will be responsible to get it to the person, whether it's inside or outside counsel. So they are familiar with what is going on before the city and will get those notices to the appropriate individual. I hope that answers your question.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Oh, just to observe, I assume this could be subverted by having a friend or family member or just about anybody else make the request for the party, because this really is specific to party, but that's in the existing statute, so I don't know if we need to go there.
That's true. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate Bill 259 be forwarded to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman has moved Senate Bill 259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Trumbull?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kuzonski?
Aye.
Representative Jennerly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 259 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman to carry the bill. And that concludes our agenda for the afternoon, colleagues. I wish you a fine weekend. We're adjourned.
See you Monday, huh?